So we were in the middle of talking about this, some frequency. So
instead of having two light beams of the same frequency, which you doubled, mm-hmm. okay, you take different light beams, one infrared and one visible, and then you tune one, and that gives you at some frequency vibrational spectrum, because you tune the energy of one of the beams while the other one beam stays constant. Okay. And that was miraculously surface sensitive, and because vibration spectroscopy is a way we identify molecules, now we could identify molecules on the surface under reaction conditions. And that was a major breakthrough of going to high pressures and do chemistry, identifying the molecular structures as they turn over and do catalysis.
Right.
Okay. And that was one of the first techniques that we discovered. The second was is the scanning tunneling microscope. The scanning tunneling microscope was used in always in vacuum because it was discovered that way. But it turned out that you can do scanning tunneling microscopy by atom with a little tip, okay, at high pressures. The tip didn't care. That was not obvious, but it worked. Okay. So we can go with this scanning tunneling microscope at high pressures. And so we built prototype instruments there. And usually if you build prototype instruments, you have about 5 years before anybody catches up.
Right.
Okay? Because that's usually the time scale. Even if I helped everybody to get to that, and I did, it takes about 5 years to catch up. And you have a tremendous scientific advantage because you can use that new instrument to do new science. So that was the second technique.
When you moved from the scanning tunneling microscope into high pressure, were you able to modify an existing scanning tunneling microscope?
No.
You had to kind of start.
You had to
fresh.
Be, because we were all vacuum.
Okay.
We were all vacuum. So we had to put in a high pressure. First of all, you had to go to vacuum to clean everything clean. Then you go to high pressures, and then you start the experiment to do catalysis. Okay, and that combination, you see, this is the boundaries of two fields.
Right.
And once you are comfortable with combining A and B, okay, immediately you have a totally new way of doing science and different problems you can tackle.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out that we could look at the surface atoms at high pressures. And then you ask, you know, so now what? I mean, what have you done by doing it? And it took me 2 years to figure out what this can do for us, because we didn't understand why would it be good. We have seen nothing under reaction conditions. You remember I told you yesterday that when you have a reaction, everything is mobile,
right,
moving much faster than the tip. Okay? And everything is blurred. Okay? And you see nothing but the reaction going on. But then we found that if you poison the reaction, everything stops and you get beautiful patterns, but no chemistry.
Yeah.
Okay. That was not obvious. When you do this, all you see is nothing. Okay, then my God, why did that happen? Okay. So you discover something, and now you understand it. So we found a technique that can identify mobility, and that mobility of molecules on the surface is absolutely necessary for catalysis. on a molecular level, because they have to find a site where they can do chemistry. Okay? And you now work at high pressure on a crowded surface. Everything is full of molecules. And if you go to a solid-liquid interface, and there are lots of reactions at the liquid interface, that you have maybe higher, thousand times higher molecular concentration. So the surface is very crowded. Okay? So you have to somehow do chemistry in a very crowded surface in catalysis. And so now we understood of what are some of the ingredients that is absolutely necessary to do catalysis. Mobility on the surface. And with other techniques, defects on the surface, we discovered with first with the low energy electron diffraction and then with the reaction that the steps and kinks on the surface are the sites where bonds are broken. Okay. Now you understand the outcome of this in nanoscience, because when you go to nanoparticles, you have lots of mobility and you have lots of low coordination sites. So these sites have, these atoms have only few nearest neighbors. Okay. And the catalysts are these tiny particles. Every catalyst, empirically, they put in and they develop the whole, nanoparticle architecture of catalysts everywhere, in the oil industry, in the automobile industry. But they never bothered. They always said, we need small particles to minimize the cost of the metal or something like that. Which was true. You minimize because you use very little. But that was not the reason. The reason was that it wouldn't work without these these low coordination sites where each atom is surrounded by less nearest neighbors. And if you have lots of nearest neighbors, catalysis doesn't occur. Okay. So we found that by looking for the mobility and looking at the steps, everything was small,
right.
Okay, and low coordination size. Now
may I ask, are you still looking, originally when you first got to Berkeley, you were looking at single crystal platinum surfaces kind of as your model system. Is that still a similar type of thing to what you're doing,
no.
Or has it just
well
going?
Yes and no. No, if I can help you.
Okay.
But it turns out I have a hell of a time to image the nanoparticles. Because the nanoparticles don't stay put, they move. And the tip is not controlled on that scale of the nanoscale. So, yes and no, I cannot image the nanoparticles at high pressure with a scanning tunneling microscope. I have to do it on a single crystal because I need a bigger area to get a regular image. The vibrational spectrum is no problem. I can go to nanoparticles because they average over a million of them. Okay? And so that averaging technique allows us to see, even on a small place, nanoparticles. Now, the holy grail right now, if I could find a tip which is so controlled that it has one or three atoms at the end, and only those three atoms would touch the nanoparticles, so it would be imaged.
Right.
But I haven't been able to do that. Okay, I'd love to. Now, the problem is that technology cannot control the tip geometry. So the STM, I cannot do. If I could control the tip geometry and I can put it in the theory that I have three atoms, two atoms, or whatever, I could get structures on a single molecule. But I cannot do that because the tip is uncontrolled. I can make a tip that works. And another tip which works, but sometimes it gets easily destroyed because it drops against, you know, on the atomic scale, everything is, we have to be gentle. You know? And we just simply don't have the control of the tip structure. But this is a continuous evolution of instrumentation. I think maybe, I must say, if I was 45 years old, I would spend the next 5 years to control the tip. Okay? But I choose other problems and hope somebody else would choose that one. Okay? Because there are other type of problems. Now, so what happens when you go to high pressures? You can measure reaction rates, what forming in the reaction on let's not go to nanoparticle, single crystal discarded. All these techniques work on single crystal. But I went to high pressures. Mm-hmm. It's these two techniques on single crystal. And we found the reactions occurring, and how they occur, how you break bonds, make bonds. You know, we went to bimetallics, alloys, real catalysts, okay? But they were still single crystals, more or less. Now, but at high pressures, these are the real conditions of catalysis. So then you can do many other things, except in addition to catalysis. I could look at polymer surfaces with the same techniques. And biointerfaces. I mentioned the contact lens. These are hydrogels. And you could study the surface and how they, you know, when you take it out, it's dirty, you find out what the dirt is. And if the dirt stops the oxygen diffusion to your eye, then you get red eye syndrome, and it's very painful. So then the oxygen, the water has to diffuse through the eye, and you blink to get that. And then you see some people cannot blink, and others can, but in fact, so you can look at biointerface problems, and then you say, well, what is biointerface? Amino acids, which form peptides, and then those peptides form proteins. And so you can go into the biointerfaces of how the body do things with at the surface. Your body is basically a polymer surface in water.
Right.
With a layer of proteins on it. Okay, that's the human body. Okay. And so if you look at a polymer and then in water, and then you adsorb amino acids, which you can polymerize to a peptide and polymerize to a protein, you are on to doing biointerface in the medical sense. Okay. So that was a major area. And I did that, because I love to find out how to do that with the technique that I have, and most people didn't. Okay. And many of my students are now in the field. That was one field. What was the polymer? We did oxides, just get away from metals, and we did oxides, okay? And it turns out the support, the catalyst support on the catalytic converter is aluminum oxide, okay? And then you look, now we put platinum in a film on an oxide alumina, and we found that what's happening there, does the oxide changes the chemistry? The answer is yes. And then we discovered that the oxide-metal interface is a special site which, because there is charge flow between the oxide, it's like a Schottky barrier, it's a semiconductor junction.
Okay?
The charge flows from the metal to the oxide, or sometimes the other way around. Okay? And that charge flow does unique chemistry. So originally when you do metal chemistry, we call it the covalent bond chemistry. But now, when we look at the oxide metal interface, it is acid-base chemistry, because the charge it can ionize a molecule, a surface atom, to negative or positive. Okay? And that is another fundamental way to do catalysis. So catalysis really occurs with both covalent chemistry and ion chemistry. And the oxide metal interface turned out to be the ion chemistry. So I was fully into catalysis and fully into polymer and biopolymer surfaces. And it was a no-go because I got dispersed, okay? And both grew under our hand, which means students got PhDs and whatnot. And so then I had to make a decision what to do. And the decision came when nanoscience appeared.
And so this is about 2000?
2000, absolutely. 2000, my God, suddenly we would use colloid technology, okay, to make little particles all the same size, the same shape, okay. Then these are the real catalysts.
Right.
Okay. So I decided to take a jump into the colloid synthesis chemistry of nanoparticles of metals. Because you always start by doing something new that you can use to extrapolate which you know without some features like the structure or size and things like that. And so I started platinum again. Mm-hmm. Let's take platinum nanoparticles and compare them with single crystals.
Okay.
What's the difference? And so I decided at that point is to stop doing biointerfaces. I had to stop something. Mm-hmm. And the nanoparticles are so much was in the catalytic folklore, partly small particles. Oh my God, let's do, of course, go for synthesis of nanoparticles and use them with as a catalyst. And I stopped doing about 5 years ago or so biointerfaces. Now when you go to a new field, you get the problem. You don't understand what you're doing. Okay. It turns out that when I made nanoparticles, I can make beautiful size from 1 to 10 nanometers, same size, same structure, surface structure, because there are very loose crystals. But in order to make it, and you could put it in a bottle, mm-hmm. It had to be capped with an organic cap,
mm-hmm.
because the organic caps have low energy and they don't stick. Okay, the metal, the naked metal would stick.
Right.
So the cap. All right. So can I do chemistry through an organic cap? The answer is yes, because the cap had to be porous, and we found out how to make that. Okay. And sometimes you make an inorganic cap, it's called a core shell structure, because the core is a metal nanoparticle, and the shell around it is oxide, titanium, aluminum, silica, or something. And that has very different properties. So you have to take apart the nanoparticle. okay, to make sure that you look at the metal underneath, mm-hmm. okay. And so that was a very interesting structure, material science problem to do that.
Did you have collaborators or people that you were working with outside of the group to help assist you in transitioning to this?
Well, yes and no. The people on the outside of the group were going for semiconductor properties, light emission, electron transport, okay? And so catalysis was not their interest, okay? But it was mine, okay? And so I did catalysis, but I used the knowledge that was accumulating on material science to make various nanoparticle structures and alloys and bimetallics, etc. So you use the same technology, but you focus on catalysis and not making water splitting or light emission or something like that. But there's a cross-learning. This is why it's so important that my students learn synthesis, because then they can run with it for another field, okay? And catalysis, because then they can stay in catalysis, okay? Etc. So we learn now how to make catalysts that do every reaction that we know how to do from the literature, from the technology. Okay? And it was no longer a single crystal phase. But we can get sometimes the same reaction on the right nanoparticle structure, sometimes not. Mm-hmm. So we found a major discovery of, I would say, probably of my life, is that what controls catalytic reactions is the size and shape of the nanoparticle. Mm-hmm. So you change the size and the shape, then you get different products. The question is why? Well, it's not obvious, absolutely not obvious. And so what we find is that when you change the size, the coordinate, are we okay?
Oh, we're fine.
Yeah, yeah. When you change the size, the number of coordination atoms, how many atoms this has as nearest neighbors, mm-hmm. it changes. And that cluster size changes the electronic structure, and the oxidation state, and everything. So just by changing the size, you do different chemistry. And in some reaction, the shape change means that one crystal phase on this cluster is much more active than another one. So as you change the shape, okay, the various crystal faces give you the sum total of what they're willing to do. Okay.
Now, as you were understanding this, the fewest nearest neighbors and the crystal faces and the geometry, were you understanding it to such an extent that you could predict
yes.
what it was going to be? Okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, what we do, we do the same reaction and we change the size. Mm-hmm. Then you see how it changes. And in some cases, the size beyond a certain size didn't make any difference. But then the shape gave us different results. Okay, so you see, now we have a synthesis that we can make nanoparticles in the 1 to 10 nanometer regime easily, and we can make it any composition, bimetallic, palladium, rhodium, nickel, copper, anything that industry uses, we can do. Okay. Now, but we can control it with the shape and the size. And then, now we can do it in 2 dimensions or 3 dimensions. We can now deposit these nanoparticles as a film, and it's two-dimensional. It's called a Langmuir-Blodgett film.
Okay.
Or you can take a mesoporous oxide that we can control the pore size, again, mesoporous, but it's a three-dimensional structure. And industry uses three dimensions because they want to pack lots of catalyst in there. And then I put my nanoparticles in that catalyst, okay, in the three-dimensional mesopores, okay. And that way we can get very close to what industry does, except we control the size and the shape and the pore size of the mesopores, okay. The mesopore ought to be bigger than the little particle you put in there, otherwise it doesn't go in,
mm-hmm.
okay? And we can control all that.
Now, as you're doing this, you know, especially as you're moving into the nanoparticle area, are there, I asked you a second ago about if there are people that you were kind of collaborating with, but are there people that you are competing with, even if it's kind of a friendly competition?
Very few.
Okay.
But the I learned from them, basically, I have to tell you how I started. They were in technology, that they could make nanoparticles without controlling the size and shape, but as they were making the industrial catalyst. And so I hired as a postdoc and a visiting scientist, big people who were very good at making industrial catalysts. Okay? And then I taught them colloid chemistry to control the size.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew almost all the technology except the physical chemistry, how to make the same size or the same shape. And so I learned from them how they make the real catalyst.
Okay?
And then it took mesoporous oxides, which were all available in the size of the pores, and so we got the knowledge of the real catalytic technology into making the same size and same shape nanoparticles, okay, in three dimensions. So that was a real catalyst. I mean, whatever I'm doing, I do a high technology catalyst by controlling the pore size, the shape, and the size. Okay, and so now I can compare what I have in terms of chemistry with the industrial catalyst. And this is the holy grail. What we find is that the product distribution of the catalytic reaction totally change when you change the pore size, the shape, and the size. But we also discovered a new site, which is at the metal-oxide interface, which is the charge size. So this is called Lewis acidity. So this was the boy who was here, the PhD, got his PhD, looking at the oxide-metal interface. That's a unique site. So we can tackle both catalytic mechanisms, the covalent bond mechanism and the charge particle mechanism, which is the oxide metal interface. And so now you will revisit any important catalytic technology. And you find surprises, because when you change one of these components, size or shape or power particle size, the products totally change.
Mm-hmm.
Or you put an alloy in there, a bimetallic, zirconium and platinum, or something like that. The products change immediately because there is a different chemistry. So we reach the atomic level study of a catalytic reaction on a metal oxide interface, which is the mainstay of the most heterogeneous catalytic. So you utilize the advances in instrumentation to do new surface instruments. You utilize the pressure that changes the picture of a crowded surface to do chemistry. And then you don't lose control of the atomic structure and molecular, the simple molecules you do on the surface. And most catalysts use a mixture of molecules, put it together. Okay? And I have yet to go there. I want to look at single molecule reactions. That's my stage of understanding. So now you can dream. Different way than without, with a single crystal. Single crystal you dream that to get away from it. Single crystal you dream to go to high pressures.
Right.
How to do that without losing the molecular understanding. So now you went to nanoparticles, and this is a real catalytic system, and you understand the low coordination because that's what makes you change the chemistry as you change the size.
Mm-hmm.
We discovered, for example, that when you go below 1 nanometer,
below
1 nanometer,
mm-hmm.
1 nanometer is 40 atoms.
Uh-huh.
If you go below 1 nanometer, 100 atoms or so, the metal is no longer an atom. It's an oxide. It has charge. The electronic structure changes when there is no bulk. Okay, these atoms are platinum 2 plus and platinum 4 plus, rhodium 3 plus, okay, gold 4 plus. Okay, and so the chemistry changes because of the electronic structure changes. And so now we went to a range of homogeneous catalysis, which is usually in a liquid phase, organic liquid. It's a transition metal ion, a single ion, okay, surrounded by ligands of molecules. And these clusters, these small clusters, 40 atoms or so, are the same ions that the organic chemistry, homogeneous catalysis people used. They were not metal atoms. So I got together with my colleague, the homogeneous catalysis because, and we put these clusters instead of a homogeneous ion, okay? And we did the same reactions on the clusters, and we had no problem, absolutely no problem, to get the same results.
I'm sorry, did you say who the colleague was that you...
Dean Tost.
Oh, okay.
Dean Tost, mm-hmm. Okay. A very good organic chemist, but he did homogeneous analysis. And he's open-minded. You have to have, and not all organic chemists open-minded. So we did that. And, but with a fantastic discovery is that the problem for the homogeneous catalysis, that the catalyst is small, and it is in the same solution where the product form, the reactants come in, and they all mixed up. And it is very difficult to separate the catalyst from the reactant and products. But we put these clusters on a... You're okay?
We're okay. I just...
Yeah, yeah.
It's a new recorder for me, and so I just always want to make sure that it's okay.
And what we found is that we can put these clusters on a support, okay, a dendron, a polymerism.
Uh-huh.
And we found the conditions that these particles stay put and don't leach.
Right.
And the reactants fly by and the product flow by, okay, and the catalyst is easily separable from the reactant and product. So this is a major revolution now for the pharmaceutical industry, because all the homogeneous catalysts make these complex molecules of steric properties and enantiosymmetric properties, where the molecules that make the properties, the shape and the static properties make it poisonous or beneficial. Okay, and so we can make complex molecules. Now with the clusters, and easily separate the products and the reactants from the catalyst. And so we continue. We have a program, and this is ongoing research. So then, green. It appears that if you look at all three fields of catalysis, homogeneous, heterogeneous, and enzyme, all the catalysts are nanoparticles. Except the enzyme catalyst work in water, and they have a protein wrap around the active site. Okay, so now we could heterogenize homogeneous catalysis with the intost.
Okay. Right.
So can we heterogenize enzyme catalysis?
Now, if you're working, again, to use the phrase you keep using, kind of at the interface of the two fields, at the interface of heterogeneous catalysis and homogeneous catalysis, do those labels, what type of catalysis it's been described as, does that label become unimportant?
Well, absolutely. Okay. It's a hybrid catalyst. The hybrid catalyst, as long as you get the same products
right. That
you get with one or the other, okay, then you can claim that it works under different conditions which are more useful in homogeneous catalysis.
Right. And if you can understand the function and the surfaces and the way that the catalyst is working, the nanoparticle is working, it doesn't necessarily matter how you describe that catalyst.
But you have to understand why it does that, that you can do heterogeneous homogeneous catalysis. It turns out that it was a very simple trick that allowed us to do that. The supported cluster was hydrophilic, and the solvent had to be hydrophobic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So hydrophobic anisole, benzene, toluene was hydrophobic. As long as the dendromer support and the nanoparticle that we deposited with the organic cap, hydrophilic, it didn't leach
right. Into
the hydrophobic solvent. Okay. If we put in water, it leached, okay, because it was hydrophilic. And the catalyst was hydrophilic. So it was very simple to keep it stable, okay, with this one, but we had to find out, you know, how to do that.
And right, so simple, of course, once you know.
Of course, but absolutely. Now, this is the key statement of science taking over of every field of application. Whether it's biointerfaces or pure human body or catalytic technology. Once you understand, I could explain, once we did ammonia synthesis of iron, and I had 30 times more turnover rate on my single crystals than ICI in England, and they came to me and said, why do you have a higher limit? And when I looked at how they did it, and it was very simple. They combined the co-catalysts in a way that they got side reactions, and it was no co-catalyst, but it was a piece of rock. Okay? And all you had to do is add the co-catalyst in a different manner, and then they got the same thing that I did. Okay? Sometimes these are very simple things that control things. But the knowledge is the difference. Okay. Always the knowledge. Okay. And this is why academia that focuses on knowledge gaining is taking over fundamental research. And the technology takes advantage of that by paying for us, mm-hmm. okay, or having institutes where they attract people to work, like a cancer institute, diabetes institute. So the science got separated in academia because we deal with more and more complicated chemistry, and the technology runs ahead. Okay, so right now, I think this is the last real challenge that I'd like to solve, is how to do enzyme catalysis in a hybrid mode with heterogeneous catalysts there. And I have been thinking about that, and there is a huge change in my thinking that must take place to tackle enzymes. If you have a human body with the enzymes, and there is a fetus, the fetus takes 9 months, very slow, and come out as a human being with very little damage of organs. Mm-hmm. Okay? So it is tremendously selective, but slow. I have to, with my hair, it may not look much, but I have to go to a haircut in every 3 weeks. It grows, and I have it cut and grown, and it's always the same hair.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Enzyme catalysis is slow, but it's very selective. And it is the result of not one catalyst, but a series of catalysts that work in tandem. So whatever reaction intermediate you get here, it moves over to another catalyst, and it does something else, and then it goes to another catalyst, and somehow, which I certainly don't understand, it always does the same thing, slowly, but it always does the same thing. So the enzyme catalytic, and this is a dream, this is my thinking, the enzyme catalysis works with a catalytic architecture. While homogeneous or heterogeneous catalysis in this mode works with a single catalyst. Okay? So it's a very different approach. I get a product like high octane isomers or product for high octane gasoline with a single catalyst. It's not obvious that it cannot work with two catalysts or three catalysts and end up with a different product. Okay? But I never tried, because I already got the product. Homogeneous catalysis, we find now, if all we have to do is change the flow rate in the liquid, then you get a primary product and then a secondary product, which forms much slower. Okay, so when you start to slow things down, there are intermediates that can be identified. Now, in an enzyme, if you want a baby, you don't stop the intermediates, okay? But you wait 9 months and you get to the final product. Okay? So it works with a catalytic architecture. Okay? How to make that? I don't understand this architectural process at all, because I dealt with single catalysts to do relatively simple molecules as compared to a human being. And so now I am trying to learn enzymes. I have no idea how the enzymes work. But I have some colleagues, they don't know what they're doing, but they can make certain products with enzyme catalysts. And I'm just trying to learn with two of my postdocs and graduate students of how enzymes make an architecture that makes a sequential product.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, once I learned, I will try to use more than one catalyst to make something else. And in my homogeneous part, the flow rate already shows different product happening and on different time scales. But that is not an architecture, because the architecture is that you have intermediates that grow an organ, or a hair, or a skin. Okay. And so this one is a challenge to me. Okay. It's a very different catalytic chemistry than the simple-minded homogeneous and heterogeneous chemistry. So I have to go from in all my life, scientific life, I always simplified things. I went to a single crystal, not a particle, because I could understand a single crystal. Okay. And then when a single crystal was all 1-1-1 faces, and it did absolutely no chemistry, absolutely nothing. And then I cut the crystal and got a stack or a kink on the stack. It suddenly started to do H2V2 exchange chemistry. So you go from a blank passive surface that should be doing that, and it doesn't. Okay? And try to find how to go for it. Okay? And I finally ended up with nanoparticles, because it's all low coordination and flexibility. But that is not how you make a baby. So I'm trying to learn this catalytic architecture. How two or three or four enzymes work together. Yeah. And that's the future. You see the thinking process? The dream changes as you get some new discoveries that allows you to go to high pressure, and go to, the instrumentation is key. I can buy instruments. And so now what? I mean, I have to find the reaction, how it jointly makes something else. And I don't understand that at all. So this is the learning. This is what you see is my life. Okay. And the dream is the most important. In every point of discovery, you say, what do I do with this? Okay. And then you find a way of building on the knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And we found that an oxide metal interface does different chemistry. It was known for 20 years, but nobody understood it.
How much longer do you anticipate running a group that's approximately 20 people to work on trying to understand this architecture as best you can? Or if that's not a question you can answer at this point?
I'm 78. The probabilities of something happening to me health-wise would exponentially increase with every year. So I'm thinking that for 2 more years, then I will be 80. Okay. Fortunately, I'm healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Your health and what?
Exactly.
I can handle this. At least I think. Next week, I go to Penn State and Iowa State to visit some of my faculty, old students who are on the faculty there, because I promised. In the middle of February to go to Iowa and then Pennsylvania. Maybe I'm tempting God, okay? But it becomes harder to, because I'm fearful, okay, that something happened. And that's no good, because it's a global thing, and I have to go to the academy meeting, funding, you have to think for yourself. Right. I had a major review of half of my money in DOE and the other half coming in March. And so I can do this, I would say, and invest this in finding a job for people. I'm in basic employment office. I can think I can do it definitely for 2 years until I'm 80.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, I'm looking for a young guy who would like to be a superstar. And I have two of my students here who are like, and one of them, Elad Gross, Israeli, he decided to go back to Israel. He got all the offers of every Israeli university, and he doesn't want to stay here with his wife. They have three children. The other guy is excellent, who was here while you were here, Robert Baker, who is a Mormon, fantastic, experimentally, he's creative, he's dreaming, and he can get his dream fulfilled because he's so talented.
Mm-hmm.
If I can convince my colleagues to give him an assistant professorship, and he did that, and he just interviewed him. But he's looking elsewhere. He got an offer from Ohio State, Texas A&M, and let's see where else. But in fact, I want him in there. He's certainly a 30 caliber. But I have to tell you, the judgment is crucial.
Mm-hmm.
These were, in addition to these two, I had two, no more than two out of my 400 postdocs and graduate students who I thought was dirty caliber. And they all employed and they do beautiful science.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But that creativity, a combination with experimental prowess, okay, and the dream, okay, is not, you cannot teach. Right? And so this guy has it. So he interviewed very well, and listened to him. And if he gets an assistant professorship, then I can help him to set up the laboratory, lots of equipment. And then I will retire to be a professor of the graduate school, which means I will not teach. And I'm teaching the physical chemistry laboratory, and I'm building, you know, I mean, I'm a full-time teacher. You cannot play a game that you don't teach. And I like to teach. I would think that if he would be employed here, then it would be fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other demands in the department, and also I'm doing my best to sell, and the fact that I'm going to bow out, okay, if it works, you will know. But it will be decided, I would say, within the next 3 months or so. Then everything looks better. And then I will retire the professor in graduate school, stay in research, but probably no longer any graduate students,
mm-hmm.
but only postdocs. I can get postdocs free of charge. They come here with their own money to get a degree, because that's a ticket for the jobs. So I don't see anything. I have no hobbies other than science. I don't play golf. I like to keep as long as my health allows.
Okay.
Fortunately, my brain is okay, and that's, I would say, the most important part of my body in this situation. But exercise is very important, so I try to do that with my wife. We walk, we don't run anymore, we walk. But as long as I can, I'd like to do it.
You mentioned the difficulties of traveling across the country in the winter, and especially this winter. It's been so cold and so snowy in so much of the country. Do you do much international travel still?
Yes. I mean, you know, I'm the chair of the advisor, the international advisory group for the Norwegians that convert natural gas to liquids.
Uh-huh.
They have a law that they cannot burn natural gas from the North Sea.
Right.
They have to convert it to something else, and that is basically gas to liquids, Fischer-Tropsch reaction, and similar thing. I had that for about 6 years now, okay. And I'm the chair of the UNICAT, Merkel put in 500 million euros into Berlin for a combined catalysis institute. The idea being that they do homogeneous, heterogeneous, and enzymes, but they focus on methane, okay, which is a major mistake. But anyhow, so there is a major interaction with the international community. And then I have to show, you know, there's a Samogi Award in my name for the ACS. We donated the money when I got some awards. And I have a Berkeley Award in Samogi Professorship, which is from the Miller Institute. So young professors coming in chemistry for a 6 month to 2 year visit. So, you know, I don't need more money. I mean, that's not a question of money, but as long as I'm active, there is some money flow, mm-hmm. which I can use to donate. I just like to stay healthy with my brain in the foreseeable future, so I can do work, even though I will not take graduate students anymore.
Right. You mentioned, of course, the Samogi Award that ACS gives out in your name, but you've been the recipient of quite a few very exciting awards here.
Yeah.
Not only a member of the National Academy,
yeah.
You know, you've won the Priestley Medal, you've won the National Medal of Science, you've won the Wolf Prize, a number of other awards, and I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about what those have meant.
Well, if you look at the book, at the in the final chapter, I listed the prizes. This is part of the selection of faculty or anywhere else in sciences or technologies of people are achieving of achievement. And it's very important because it separates people by an award which may be $2,000 or $5,000 worth. And there are other ways of separating, because you can measure success other than awards. But this is a very nationally important thing. And then it becomes also an international aspect of visibility. And so now you will see that you can classify people you have water, but you don't have water outside. So these awards have a pecking order. Okay. The ACS does an excellent job of giving for young people, you know, achievers, somehow. Also, NIH does a good job in the institute. I don't know what to say. I mean, this is a selection process. And when we take new faculty or try to get somebody, this is the recognition is partly of these awards, very competitive. There are a few awards that are very personal awards, which doesn't necessarily go for quality. Okay? The Templeton Award for importance of science in religion. It's an important award, but very special. So these show did you read New York Times?
Yeah.
The Sunday New York Times. It was a beautiful article about the review of the week. And there was a professor, I think two Princeton professors from the end, said that what do we mean by upward mobility? You ought to read that. So the U.S. is better to upward mobility. So how does that happen? What sort of qualities you need to So they said that, well, the people who are upward in the town have no self-confidence, but also have a superiority complex combined, okay? And they know that they are good, but they are not not feeling that they how to accomplish the rewards of their work, okay? And so they are always looking for other ways of proof. Now, so the award system speaks to that, okay? Because you distinguish yourself, okay? And then it makes you feel good, and it adds to your superiority feeling. It distinguishes you from the masses. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it's always need to prove yourself. You get another award, it gives you that satisfaction. But the third thing is in upward mobility that is very important, according to this article, was delayed gratification. Mm-hmm. So you build up knowledge or whatever you want to reach that critical point, okay? And so this does not exist in most other countries. England has that. Germany, not much. Other European, Hungary has. Okay, so there is a psychology here, mm-hmm, that appears to help to separate excellence.
On a completely different topic, one of the things that I was curious about, of course we talked at length yesterday about your life in Hungary and leaving Hungary with your sister and your soon-to-be wife. And I was curious if you went back to Hungary at some point, if you've gone back to visit.
Yes. I didn't go back for 31 years, because when I escaped, I was convicted to 10 years of labor, forced labor, and I was not about to try them out. Okay, so then after 10 years, there was an amnesty, around 68 or so. then I didn't go back, because anybody who went back was immediately requested by the security police to try to spy on the country of where they came from, etc. So this was a typical communist socialist. But then came the, I was invited, you know, I became an academy member in 79, and then I got an offer from the ATR in Switzerland and to take over from a Professor Piero Pino, who was retiring. They have very strict rules of retirement. He was 65. Mm-hmm. He was a Catholic, homogeneous Catholic guy, to take over, and they got a beautiful offer. So I went there, and while I was there, I visited Novosibirsk, because the Russians invited me. There was a Catholicism Institute in Siberia, because Zamarayev was, anyhow, they invited me, and they were assured of safety. I was curious, but the stupid I was, I had a sort of superiority feeling that I'm untouchable because I'm good. And it could cause an international scandal or something, which was not true. I mean, the stupidity of people who feel secure is not to be underestimated. I can tell you, since I went to China with this thing, and obviously they were up there. I went to Nanjing, which is close to Taiwan, and at that point the Taiwanese and the Chinese were shooting at each other, okay? And so I tried to take a walk, and I was not allowed to take a walk, and I was immediately, there are things, when life is good, you forget about all the bad things, okay? And then something, an accident happens, that jars, and shocks you back to reality, okay? And that happened to me in China, okay? I just wanted to get out of there, because I was afraid for my security. So I went to Novosibirsk, and I came out from that. It was a very interesting visit for many reasons. And so then I got this offer. I went from Switzerland, went back to Piero Pino, and I was there. And then came a Hungarian invitation in 1987. One year after I escaped, 31 years after I escaped, mm-hmm. I was invited. What the hell, I survived Siberia, okay? Why not go back to Hungary? So I went back to Hungary, Budapest, with my wife, and carried everywhere, and they gave me the honorary doctorate degree at the Technical University that I never finished.
Right.
Okay? And then I became a foreign member of the Hungarian Academy. They were very nice. And so at that point, they asked me to chair an advisory board, international advisory board, to take their academy institutes, to bring them up to modern standards. Mm-hmm. And there are 52 institutes. I have the booklet there to show the institute. And in the chemical side, I put together a group of scientists, Peter Stang. I don't know what you know.
I know the name.
Yeah, Peter was also of Hungarian origin. And, Hungarian origin, who was in Germany, from Denmark or here, so we went in there and consulted them and tried to see what they do and how they do it. And for 6 years, I was on the advice that we made great advances. Mm-hmm. But then there was a government change. And the new government became very nationalistic. And within a year, they dismantled all the international advisory boards because only Hungarians can advise Hungarians, which is as stupid as you can think of. The problem is, in a small country, you cannot be honest in your evaluation, because if you have a bad opinion of somebody, they know immediately who
right.
where is it coming from, and then there is revenge, okay, because they do that to you. Okay, I mean, you have to have an advisory board that is decoupled from the system. And we do that here in the U.S., and that's the only way it works. So they dismantled the advisory board, and I haven't been back. But I went back twice to take my grandchildren back to look at my old family house, and my wife's family house. And there are two families. I have two children, and they have two children of their own, and I took them separately. Okay. And so we revisit that, and the countryside, and so at least they have a sense of their roots.
Right. Do your children speak Hungarian?
No. No. My daughter, who is the oldest one of my two, speaks Hungarian, has a very nice vocabulary. But she cannot write.
Yes.
It's very interesting. And my wife and I mix the language, but more and more is English, because we speak English all the time. But when my mother-in-law or my mother was alive, then when we visited them, it was obvious that we visited them, because then we spoke to each other more Hungarian. So it was immediately obvious what did we do with our parents,
right.
Okay, because of the language. I'm fluent in Hungarian. I can write, and of course, no problem. But you acclimatize very rapidly.
Now, did your parents ever have an opportunity to leave Hungary, or did they?
Oh yeah, it is. So I came out, I escaped, and then we got a green card. 57 years, yeah. And then 5 years later, we became citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And by that time, I was at IBM. And so we hired a lawyer, and we got our parents over here.
Okay.
And my father was. 1962, he was 60 years old. He was 1902, he was 60 years old. And my father and mother opened a children's clothing store between babies to 4 years old or something like that. And the two of them were running that shop, and very successfully, and they were totally independent. My father was never accepted a penny from them. It was a matter of, of his decision for them. It's amazing. And then he died at age 82, and my mother lived another 10 years, and when she passed away. So he ran the store after my father died, and they made a very decent living in a small store. But they gave them independence.
It's wonderful.
Yeah. But you see, the bottom line is that all the talent my father had, and he was a genius in math, spent with the Bible, 100%, and tried to give us something in the worst of circumstances that allow us to function. And I have none of that problem. I mean, maybe I have talent, but I can use my talent in doing things that are constructive and not survive. And so this is not an unlike immigrant situation, except we came first and they came after.
It was wonderful, though, that you were able to bring them over here for so long. It's great.
If you look at the evolution of the Jewish experience in Europe, have you ever read a book called The Pity of It All?
No. It sounds familiar, but
you must read that. Okay. The Pity of It All was written by Alon, A-L-O-N. He was, I think, an Israeli writer. It's about the German Jews. It starts around the 1650s when, what was the name of the philosopher?
Spinoza?
The German, and there was a musician with the same name, Mendelssohn.
Mm-hmm.
Mendelssohn arriving at a gate of Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
At the gate where only animals and Jews could enter.
Okay.
And he had to pay when they entered. And so that started the influx of Jews into Germany. To Berlin. And so he describes the history and how they assimilated in society and the accent of Heine, the poet, and the writers and the bankers and the scientists. Okay. And it ends at 1933, January, when Hitler took over.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the end of it. Mm-hmm. It showed how they integrated into society. And so the book's title is The Pity of It All. Okay. It expresses the whole story, which got to an abrupt end. It's a very interesting story. The Hungarian story was not that long, but it was very interesting because of they integrated into society and they contributed to it. There was in Hungary, unlike in Germany, there was no middle class. There it was a feudal country, and the peasants didn't get any voting rights until the end of the 19th century. And so they were on feudal and agricultural country. So then they become modern from after 1848, the revolution came. Then they became lawyers and doctors. The middle class and businessmen, etc. And I would say 90% of the middle class was Jewish. And so it was not a question of religion, but it's a question that they immigrated into a vacuum, okay, from Poland or from Austria. And so, okay, so then when anti-Semitism came, it instantly affected the middle class. It's a very interesting story, but this is not something that I want to talk about it in my autobiography.
It is very interesting. My my mom's family were German Jews, but they came in the middle of the 19th century, so they came to the United States much, much earlier. And my father's family was Russian Jews, but they came at the turn of the century. It's such interesting history.
Absolutely, that you ought to read that book, because that would resonate.
Yeah.
Do you ever go to New York City?
Not recently, but I have family there.
That is a museum. One block from the Metropolitan. It is an Austrian-German art museum where this guy who did that escape after the Anschluss and came to there, and he got all the refugees' art pieces, and he took some Kokoschka, Schiele, Klimt, you know, the gold lady, and fantastic museum. And they have an Austro-Hungarian restaurant at the bottom, great food, okay? And it's a small museum. Okay? And so in the shop, library, bookshop, they have the books. I saw that Pity of It All. Okay? So if you want to buy a book, you can buy it here. But I bought it on Amazon.
Yeah, I've heard of it before.
It was such a complete story of starting from nothing, and then stopped the book when they got exterminated. You know, the reason I wrote the autobiography is to put a historical perspective the rise of U.S. science through my stuff, which I know.
Right.
I don't want to write about things that I don't know. So, and there is an enormous change, and the exponential rise is due to the exponential rise of terrorism. Of course, that foundation, you know, my money is $150 billion in 2012 out of $150 million in 1957. Okay? I mean, we are rising like a renaissance.
Yes.
Okay? And that made us world class. Now, I don't know how the chemical heritage had a view of a dream of how to present this. But it is such a tremendously inspiring story. It ought to be presented as such.
Yes.
Yeah. And it has many facets, the manufacturing facets, chemical problems of industrial pollution, and how we get out of this, the reach, military reach, for example, Dow using whatever the Agent Orange or something in Vietnam. It basically the chemical warfare is what we were stolen.
Yes.
And the Bhopal that we sold a technology that we never used because it was so dangerous in the U.S., but we used it in India. And so, and then the rise of the oil industry, and then the science, and how we increase life expectancy. And all the things we lived with that was scientifically inspired, going to the molecular level, the atomic scale, and then the electronics stuff, the sensor technology. The instrumentation, NMR, that you would put you in a machine to find out whether you're still alive or not. So the modern medicine is obviously the part of this. But everything else, I mean, the catalysis is an excellent example of what you're doing. And how it changes from industry to academia. And this change occurred in the last
100 years. Yeah.
The segmentation of the technology, and then how you combine the two. The problem is that in industry, they hardly have any good science left. And you ought to have scientists on the industrial side
right.
to be able to talk with the academia. And that is a major, major problem. The reason why I have a beautiful interaction with Chaplin is one man who is a smart guy, and if he was not there, all the rest were totally hopeless because of the lack of knowledge of how science and that technology operates on an atomic scale. And the Honda is the same. This guy who was here, this baker, Chris Brooks from Ohio, he comes to the Honda laboratory, and he comes and do science at the light source here. And he gives us money to work on the lithium battery. Okay? And so he's one man, he's in the whole company that works on this interest. This is an exceedingly fragile system. But I think we will overcome that when companies go bankrupt. I mean, they don't keep up with the technology. They lose their scientific infrastructure. But, you know, General Motors went back. But they seem to be coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand that because I don't see the talent pool to be able to move with the new technology. But that means I don't understand the strengths and weaknesses of that system.
Right.
But that interaction, academia and industry, is our big and exceedingly important. Maybe we will develop an institutional structure somehow that will serve a certain industry, you know, oil industry, acid with that.
Mm-hmm.
The research arm of ESSEL was European, University of World Problems that were in Chicago, and they're still in Chicago. And they developed the technology. And there, it was related to the director of a professor in Northwestern,
mm-hmm.
Ipachev.
Mm-hmm.
You know, have you read the book, there's an Ipachev book of his life history?
I don't know.
It's a tremendous story. Ipachev was the father of of Russia. He discovered the clay pipe, the Russian clay pipe. And he put some organic papers there, and the oxide catalysis. Ipachev was a war criminal like Haber was, and he developed the gas war from the Russian side.
Mm-hmm.
And so then after the revolution, the Russian. Lenin put him in charge of the Russian Academy of Sciences to build up the chemical industry in Russia. And he had a very close contact with Catalan, was doing catalysis in Russia. And then Lenin died, and Stalin killed all his co-workers. And when it happened, he took the last train out of Russia and went to Berlin, and then he escaped. He came to the U.S. and he Northwestern became professor of Northwestern and the director of UOP, the Rockefeller SO Research Laboratory. And in that capacity, he and Vernon Pines, his graduate student from Northwestern, developed iso-octane.
Yes.
You probably know that story.
Yeah, it's part of the story.
Fantastic. And then the English took over, and by the Battle of Britain, the English had run the Spitfires with 100 octane gasoline, while the Germans run on synthetic gas, synthetic liquids, okay, 56 octane. And so the British did the same plane, basically, to stay in the air twice as long. Okay. So that was the chemical version of the end of the Battle of Britain. And so this guy, you know, people like this have made marvelous stories of catalysis.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the Russian winter, you had to ride fire under the tank, a German tank, because it was so solid. The melting point was very, very high. And so, I mean, they couldn't fight with tanks, with the fuel they had. Anyhow, lots of stories like this. And if you do it in catalysis, you have to look at these stories.
Mm-hmm.
How $1 million in gold buys the Standard Oil of California, put in at the foot of the Saudi sheikh or whatever, to get a hold of being able to get the oil out from Saudi Arabia. Okay, the whole change from oil-based industry from acetylene, basically coal and gas-based industry. Anyhow, the catalysis story is marvelous. You should look at it. And my book has some of this, but very narrow. But the modern story is probably the most important. It's the academia industry separation and how it plays out.
Talking for a long time, and you've come to the end of my questions. So if there's anything else,
okay.
Thank you.
And you are trying to do a good thing.
I hope so. Thank you very much for all of your time.
Very good.